Thank you, Alec, and thank you, everybody, for coming to listen this afternoon. I think first and foremost, I need to make an apology for falling into the same trap I was warned about in all three of the first speakers' talks today, and that is never believe the press. So I received a press release that Pravin Gordhan had passed away, and then I got a whole lot of various messages that, in fact, he's still on life support and not passed away. So firstly, just apology on that. It shows you don't jump to conclusions on what the press tells you. Secondly, just a thank you to Alec, because the last time I was here in this room for BNC6, I brought a presentation. I was sitting, I think, over here in the front rows, and I was told we don't have any facility for the presentation, so you're just going to have to wing it for 20 minutes. So this time, at least, I've got some form of presentation, so I'm just going to refer to a few slides, but I do feel more comfortable often following a presentation than not. So I just thought, many of you have heard me before, but some of you are new faces. You don't know 361. Again, like Pitt, we're a lot smaller asset manager than the larger names you're used to, the Coronations, 91s, Allan Grays, etc. We manage probably 10% of the AUM of their businesses, so we're a lot smaller. But we have our own track record, where we, the people who've started it, are still managing those assets. There's no turnover of the managers. It's the same people. So when you see the track record, it's actually ours. Our approach is very all over the place, in fact. We're not a value manager. We're not a growth manager. We want to remain nimble. We want to believe in South Africa as much as we can. But if we think we shouldn't, then we're happy to move all the money offshore. So we move around as much as we can to ensure that we do the best for our clients. We have a very diverse product offering, so we're one of the two largest hedge fund managers in the country. We do long only, and we have balanced funds, etc. So we're not telling any one client, you should be in a hedge fund, you should be in long only. I think there's a time and a place for each and every investment. So I thought it was very interesting. I last spoke here in March, you know that there's generally been, and Pitt's mentioned it as well, there's generally been a sense of take your money offshore, make sure you've got as much offshore as you can. So what I thought I'd do today, and previously I've spoken mostly on hedge funds, is actually just look at our SA-only equity portfolio. So this is a long-only portfolio, has to be fully invested in the JSE stocks, and look what it's done over the last number of years. Not so much in the performance, but in the fact that if you look at what the actual domestic equity component is of this portfolio going back, you would see that just over a year ago, we had about 32% in domestic equities. Domestic equities meaning your banks, your insurers, your local retail companies, and approximately almost 70% in those Rand hedges, those Richemonts, Anglo-Americans, British American Tobaccos. We stood here, like Pitt did, and like Professor Cronier did as well, and spoke very positively on what we thought the outcome of the election would be. And in fact, we did one thing a little bit further than that, is we looked at valuations about a year ago and 9 months ago in relation to when had SA been this cheap. And we didn't only look at the small and mid caps, because we're a lot bigger company. We looked at a lot of the larger caps, and we did some valuation measuring and found a very interesting thing. The last time that big South African stocks like First Rand and Standard Bank and Old Mutual and Sanlam were this cheap was on the weekend of the 10th of December 2015, when Nene was removed as finance minister. So basically, that's where we thought we were, and the outcome we thought couldn't get really worse. I mean, obviously, the election did go in favor of what we wanted. But the truth is, you had an unbelievable opportunity at the time to buy equities in South Africa, basically where the mentality was that the ANC was going to rule forever and who knows who was going to be the president and everything was going to fall over. So as much as we all like to criticize, I think we're at a point now where we can say this has been a very successful year for South Africa. The GNU has just started, and although we read negative things again from the press around the education bill, etc., we are finding little small pockets of improvements everywhere, and actually we're quite excited. Another thing I thought, and this my esteemed colleague in the front here has always said, and I know I believe you altered it slightly this year, you know, have as much money as you can outside of South Africa, because you can see how well American markets have done, and you can see how poorly South African markets have done. But in South Africa, even in a long-only equity portfolio, had you been able to move around between international stocks and local stocks, this is what 361 has managed to do in US dollars, year-to-date, 1 year, 3 year, and 5 year, against the global indices and against the S&P 500 in dollars. So this is a dollar-based net performance. So I know a lot of people have thought, well, I've got to take my money as fast as I can out of SA over the past 5 years. But in fact, had you been with the right manager, and we're not the only right manager, you could have in fact kept up with the pace of offshore markets in US dollars had you been correctly invested in the right sectors in the JSE. So now what's happened? We've seen a good rally. Markets have done well. You know, ShopRite's up 40%. A lot of companies have continued to go up. But if we look back over the last 10 years, GDP growth has averaged around 0.8%. It's really been mediocre. And that's where you've been right, is that you needed, you know, previously probably a lot of your money offshore. But things started turning. And now we have various growth initiatives. We have a new government. And we have this general centrist view that people want to fix things. And we've got a potential growth forecast going forward. And in fact, I'm not going to get to the numbers behind it, but 2% was mentioned even by Dr. Cronier. And let me tell you that if you look at South African emerging markets and you take 2% going forward from this point in time and you measure us against other emerging markets for our valuation, it means the SA market is actually still very cheap. So we don't think this market has at all discounted the fact that South Africa could become a growth emerging market again. Many of you might not have heard of Operation Vulindlela, and it's quite a complex initiative, but it's effectively started by National Treasury with government looking at certain aspects of our economy that have slowed the economy down. Obviously, electricity, and we've seen that one's been dealt with very efficiently, and water, another crisis, ensuring proper digitization of our economy. And all these initiatives were, in fact, started by National Treasury. And there's a committee in place. It's actually got a report on a monthly basis. We're seeing various initiatives. And I think people are very much unaware of this. The same as the gold and financial continuity reserve. If you read about that in the press, you think South Africa's throwing in the towel and destroying its balance sheet. It was actually a very cleverly thought-out program. We have all these DA ministers on board now. It's also helping. So really, I think the message from us is that things have seriously changed from a few months ago to today. And I think South Africa has, at least for now, and it's not to say there aren't risks, but has set itself into a new era of potential growth. We are starting to see, and we're being contacted all the time, international institutions looking to invest in South Africa for the first time in a decade, whether it be equity investments into fund managers here, or whether it be actual assets they're looking to acquire out of listed entities or private entities. We haven't heard those noises for some time. We heard Mateto talk earlier about the EAF improvement in Eskom, and I'd actually like to tell you a quick story just about that, but I'm not sure if he's still here or not or gone. But he was rarely politically correct when he didn't make any comments about his predecessor. But the day that his predecessor left Nampak and started as the CEO of Eskom, I don't tweet that much anymore because I get legal letters, but I tweeted on the day, finally, Nampak may improve. So, you know, the difference between the two leaders is so obvious to me, in their personalities, in the way they build a business, in the way they confront staff, in the way they build up a business from bottom up. You know, I doubt Mateto's going to write a book about himself. And there's, you know, it was an absolute frustration of ours that the government allowed him to continue the role as the head of Eskom for that amount of time. And you can see the massive improvement that Mateto's made. And I think people don't give him enough credit because he's softly spoken, kind, and most importantly, very humble. What we need to see in South Africa again is improved logistics. And that's also part of this Operation Vulindlela, Transnet. And yes, it will take time, but we can already see improvements. And we measure the improvements at 361 actually on the monthly basis. And then what we luckily got, or unluckily got for maybe the asset management industry, but luckily for consumption and for lowering debt levels in SA, is this new two-pot system that has come about. And we have already seen billions of rands being taken out of the system of retirement, being used in spending, consumption, will help the economy. And again, what have we had that's been such a difficult thing to overcome is very high interest rates for a very long period of time. And we have hit that peak. So we've got all these factors now that look very positive. Rates are going to come down. We're expecting a rate cut this month. And I think on the back of that, with all five of these, I think South Africa is very well set and good, in a good place to continue. Also, what's happened during this time, foreign ownership of South Africa has dropped from 40% to 28%. This is foreign ownership of JSE-listed companies. And you can see just right at the bottom, just a small change around about election time. And then if you look on the right-hand side, you know, even after the run, how expensive is South Africa relative to other emerging markets? You can still see we're on the very cheap side relative to the balance of other emerging markets. I've spoken a bit about what our exposure was, and you can just see, you know, that post-GNU, our long-only fund is 60% in domestic equities versus 40% rand hedge. It has been over a decade since we've had more than 50% invested in local domestic shares. On the JSE, it has all been around the growth of rand hedges. So for us to have that type of exposure, I think is commensurate with exactly how confident we are that South Africa, for the first time in many, many years, is well positioned. Interestingly enough, someone, I think Pitt spoke earlier about competition not being great in South Africa. So it's easier in South Africa to do well now because there's not much competition. The same actually happens in the market, believe it or not. It's not that much competition in being able to analyze different sectors better than other competitors. And if you go back 10 or 15 years ago, there were 20 or 30 international firms that had specialist commodity analysts that covered gold or PGMs or steel companies or mining houses, etc. Today, those have all gone. They've exited South Africa. And quite frankly, unless you're a company who has those skills, it's very difficult to predict what's happening in the resource sector. So for us, that's become a huge advantage. And over the last, since 2019 to year-to-date 2024, we've added 30% performance just from the resource sector relative to what the resource sector represents in the index. So basically, if the index was, let's say, 20% and it grew 20%, we've actually grown 50%. So, and that's really, again, because South Africa has become far less competitive in pretty much most businesses. And in fact, you can extend that through to the market. So I think I'm almost out of time, but just to mention a bit about 361 and our funds. I've spoken today predominantly around our SA Equity Fund, which is on the top right. We also manage a general equity fund, which has got a combination of offshore and onshore in equities. We also are a multi-asset manager. So when many of you may be part of PPS, we manage actually, they outsource their balance fund to us. We also have our own flexible fund. And then what we're probably most well known for is, of course, the hedge funds, which have a bi-directional strategy where, for example, the likes of Steinhoff, or resilient or EOH or companies that we can predict are on the way down or shouldn't be at their prices, we can make money off by being short. And there are those, obviously, that we can be long that we like, that hopefully, you know, become those 10 baggers, etc., like the NASPASs, which we've held for decades. So on that note, thank you. That's the update, and I'll come and listen to you. So you had a very, very good election. Tell us about it. Yes, let's wait for the screen to go up. So I think there was a lot of risk around the election. And every time Helen Ziller opened up her Twitter account, we got a fright. But maybe Dr. Cronier will tell us that was all around negotiation tactics rather than actually looking to pull out of the GNU. But it did dampen a lot of sentiment during the time. But we felt, yeah, even going into the election, that all outcomes were going to be positive. We could see the centrist view in the ANC versus far left view. And we had our own meetings and came to our own conclusions. And I think, luckily it panned out well. And as I said, even if it had panned out to be pretty much the same, I think valuations were such that you had a decent margin of safety by the fact that the companies were going to carry on earning money, they were going to carry on growing, there's a very large informal sector in South Africa, and the valuations were just far too cheap.
Just take us inside 361. Take us inside your head ahead of the elections. When you said you had your own meetings, where do you get your information from? How do you, and you don't have to name names, no, obviously, but how do you come to a view?
So I think, you know, in the 20 years I've been at 361 and the 30 years I've been in asset management, we have a very large, high net worth client base, I think from all spheres of the market, that has resulted in a pretty very, you know, connected client base who I think, not myself, but some of them, you know, do interact with the high profile political people and strategists. And luckily I've been part of your community, so I get the likes of some very good political analysts. And I think, you know, together with all of those, you come to a view. And that's it's not my view. I mean, we're a 14-person investment team. And today, my view doesn't count as probably as much as some of the others in the team. So it's really just it's a working group that hopefully makes the right informed decision at the time.
It's also an attitude, isn't it? It's an attitude of having an open mind. And I see this continuously in the BizNews WhatsApp and our premium WhatsApp communities. We get wonderful insights there. And if you just look at it with and there are a number of regular participants on those groups here, if you just keep your mind open, you can learn so much.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I have learned there's a very big issue between being the worst character trait you can ever have in asset management is being stubborn. So I've learned that. And I know some other asset managers are out there and they love something and that's just the way it is. The market's got it wrong and we're right. I'm the exact antithesis of that. So what I'm telling you right now, that's why please don't buy into what I'm saying, because tomorrow morning I wake up and I think something totally different. So again, and I think Pitt said it as well, don't ask for stock tips because information changes, you know, every minute of every day. And but I think that's right. You've got to have an open mind to everything. And I think if at this point in time, if you step back in the world and you look at South Africa, South Africa has a story. And you'll know from investing, when you find a company that has a story, the market gives it credit for some time before you have to deliver the numbers. I mean, this is a change. This is a good story. A new government. We've got Eskom kind of fixed. There's a lot of effort going into water and transportation and
visa regulation, etc. So we've got a good story. Yes, the earnings aren't growing like they should be. The economy's been sluggish. I disagree as well, though, with the 0.8% GDP growth, because the informal sector makes up such a big component, and that's grown far quicker than the regular economy. So it's not all bad. And if you look at it from the top down, you'll say this country's got a story, and you know, next thing, earnings start growing and GDP's at 2%, and we're off to the races for a few years.
All right, and it's a good point you make there, Gigi Alcock, who comes to our annual conferences, points out that when you look at the informal sector, you bring that into the equation, which is where he works. He says that the unemployment's 12%, not 32% or 33%. So we can get baffled by numbers sometimes which aren't always accurate. But how do you make sure that you don't get sucked into that mood?
Well, I think by just being practical, by being nimble. So I think, you know, it's one thing to change your view. It's another thing to be able to change your view practically in the market. So, you know, if we had 500 billion or a trillion, or in some cases, 91's got 2 trillion, but it's, a lot of that's not in South Africa. But if we had 500 billion and we changed our mind tomorrow that we didn't like the banking sector, and we, you know, we can't do much about it. It'd take us months and months, and maybe you need to stay nimble, niche, and be able to change your investment universe, you know, pretty quickly. And I think if you can do that, then, and you've got an open mind, you've still got the ability to change.
But, and I'm going to go back to this of not being sucked in. You didn't buy Steinhoff, the buy Steinhoff story. Most others did. You didn't buy the African bank story. In fact, you made a lot of money by going against the crowd in both of those instances, i.e. selling short, as you say, selling shares you didn't own in the anticipation that you'd be able to buy them later, much cheaper. Where does that come from?
Well, that's a combination of experience, and probably my best strength is, and I'm not bragging at all about my strengths, because believe me, I'm also dumb, but I like reading people. And Marcus Yuster was a classic. So, and he classically avoided me as well. And also happened to be that I was the head auditor of JD Group, an asset that they bought prior to 2009. And, I like finding those kind of people. And I'm not going to mention others, but there have been others, and you shouldn't talk badly about the dead either. So I apologize, Marcus, but, it's an ability to find things that just don't make sense. I mean, the balance sheet of Steinhoff and the type of industry that they were in never made sense. And there's no ways that you could have got that kind of growth. And again, there was no cash flow. Whenever there's no cash flow, there's always some kind of story. I mean, a similar thing could be said about the property sector a number of years ago. All these property sectors were flying to the end of 2017 and 18, and I couldn't understand why there was no cash flow. They were all raising equity every few months, and the earnings just never made any sense. We were in a country that wasn't growing, and then this property sector is going through the roof. So I think you've got to apply just a practical approach when you understand the balance sheets, understand the people involved. I guess that's how you come to those opportunities.
So Bitcoin?
So Bitcoin, I'm not an anti-Bitcoiner, so I kind of agree with the philosophy that if you are wealthy today, you put 1% or 2% of your money into Bitcoin. And if Stafford Massey's correct, and he told me when I walked out of this room in March that Bitcoin will be 400,000 by the first quarter of 2025. I haven't forgotten that comment, so maybe he's right, maybe he's wrong. I think what does concern me about it is what it's being used for. I mean, terrorism and all types of fraud and money laundering, etc., is definitely happening via that network. And there's a lot of lost tax opportunities for the world because of Bitcoin. So I understand its uses, and I think it is, you know, and I understand its whole anti-inflation selling point, because it's a limited amount, and we're not printing it like we print currencies. But it has its, and the problem is it's not a business. It doesn't pay you a dividend. So you require confidence in the system for the next person to buy your Bitcoin at a slightly higher price. So it only lasts as long as the confidence it has in it. So it's not my, I wouldn't buy it in our funds. So I think people who put it in their funds are pretty brave. You know, we've got a license to trade equities. That's what we understand. That's what we analyze. But if anyone asked me my personal view, I'd say, well, put a couple of percent of your own money in it. It's not, you know, it's not going to damage you long term. And if it does, if Stafford Massey is right, you're going to make 8x by next year.
What might you be missing? What might you be missing in the South African story?
Well, I think in the SA story, there's always risk. We saw the education bill now being signed in, maybe without proper consultation, you know, by the DA. You know, maybe it's not so bad as the press tell us, which is what, again, what Dr. Cronier was telling me in the break. So, but I think there's risk. As we know, there are still bad factions, you know, in the ANC that are driven by greed and not driven by, you know, trying to improve South Africa for the best of all of its people. And those are the risks. The risks are that the bad trumps good, and there's a lot of money out there. You know, you down here in Amanus, you don't see it, but you come up to Johannesburg and you come to the area I live in and you see the amount of flashy cars with armored vehicles and blue lights with private people driving around and, you know, controlling the areas. It's frightening, and we need to get rid of this gangsterism that's, you know, almost above the law, is above the law.
So despite that, your ownership of South Africa Inc. has gone up, but on the other hand, the foreign ownership, which you articulated for us there, has gone down from 40 to 28%. So what are they not seeing that you are?
Well, it's what they have not seen over the last few years. I think they don't like to, and we spoke to quite a few foreigners. I mean, we actually have foreign investors who are invested in our funds in South Africa. So some very large fund of fund investors, et cetera, that are global. And we asked them, and they say, we don't commit money on chances and predictions. We wait for the ultimate outcome. So the GNU had to happen before they would really look at it. They're not in the game of predicting. So I think post this GNU, as I said before, we are seeing more interest. We've seen, for example, Barlow's basically looking to get taken out by Middle Eastern players. I think there are many more assets that are being looked at from abroad. And I think foreign participation will pick up. I mean, it's understandable given, you know, how little progress was being made by, call it, the old ANC, and the fact that there was no growth here, that most of the money had left. I mean, they'd left because there were better opportunities elsewhere. I mean, the US, agreed, has flown for, you know, two decades. I kind of agree it's very overvalued. But again, money chases, you know, what's trendy. So I think a lot of money had left here, but I think a lot of money could come back if it continues the way it started.
You read the South African election brilliantly. The US is where more than half of investable assets are sitting. How are you reading that one?
I'm terrified by the US election, in fact, because I think both results are very bad. So you, and I think I read it also correctly, and I think it was R.W. Johnson who wrote recently an article on your premium website, which I'm now a subscriber. I had some tech issues.
Don't mention those.
But I think you've got two extreme views here. We've almost lost the centrist approach, this practical centrist approach in the middle. And Trump is a big danger, and he wants to slap tariffs on everywhere and make America great again. And I think it's a bull in a china shop, and the Democrats are the exact opposite of that, and they're not doing things practically either. So what does that mean for markets and a very expensive US market? I think it's concerning. And as, you know, not talking our SA equity portfolio, which I talk now, if you looked at our hedge fund portfolio, for example, we don't have net US long exposure anymore. We have basically cut that right down. We don't have the NVIDIAs. We have a little bit of Microsoft and Amazon, but we also have put spread options. So we are protected on the downside against the US market, because the US market relative to the rest of the world has outperformed at a level that is, it's never happened before. If I showed it to you on a graph, it's something like 3 standard deviations away from the norm. So we don't think that's sustainable. And I think what's going to be, as well as the election, the fact that interest rates have remained so high in the US has helped their situation. Once US rates start coming off, I think the US dollar potentially weakens, and maybe the market, we have maybe not a full-blown recession in the US, but you have a slowdown, and I think valuations there are in trouble, and that's before the election, potentially, even though the election's not that far away. So I'd be very cautious on just US valuations in general.
And how much of that US, Europe's also looking very dodgy, the UK is looking dodgy, China's had its issues. How much of all of that international picture is informing your view on South Africa? And I just to add a rider to that, when Clem Santer spoke in March, he said, this is a pretty good part of the world to be right now, given all the nonsense that's going on elsewhere.
Yeah, I think that's very correct. I think that, look, if the US has a meltdown, the South African stock market doesn't keep going up. I mean, we come down, but I mean, we're coming down off a much lower base, much, much lower valuation base. The correction here would be far smaller. And also, we get insulated in that correction because generally in all corrections, markets run to cash, and they run to cash dollars because the dollar is still the reserve currency in the world. And our South African market is more still rand hedged than it is domestic. So actually, this market gets more insulated than pretty much most world markets because you've got these rand hedges and we have commodities, and there's often a rush to gold or platinum, etc. So I think that you're right. It is a safer place to be in a world correction, but it's still not a good place to be. You'd rather be in cash or gold, or, you know, I think Bitcoin will also collapse, but that's let's see.
Si, you mentioned quite a bit about resources and your expertise, or the research that you do on resources. Something that's been playing on my mind is Anglo Platinum. I remember that when it was far, far higher than the current share price. And it's back to, I did the number the other day, back to where it was 20 years ago, trading at the same level. And it's almost impossible to believe that this is possible. Can you help me to understand that, and by definition, what's going on with resources?
Right. So PGMs, platinum group metals, which is what AmPlats is quite a unique metal. And obviously, most of those metals go into combustion engines, so your old vehicles, basically. And obviously, with all the EVs coming, electric vehicles, which don't require any PGM metal, obviously the whole basket of these metals has fallen dramatically. And obviously that's impacted all these companies over time. And it's a funny thing you mention this, because until yesterday, in the last 6 months to 2 years, I'm guessing, we have been short the PGM sector. We haven't owned it in our long-only funds. And we've been short and making a lot of money on the likes of Sibanye from 60, which was closed yesterday at like 14 rand something, and AmPlats from 1,000 to, I don't know if you know, Anglo's placed a portion of their AmPlats in the market yesterday and reduced their stake from 78.2 to 72.7 or something, or 68, I quite forgot the exact numbers, but they placed that in the market, which caused a further slump. But I think it's a very interesting sector at the moment for a simple reason that nobody has blinked. Nobody has cut production. So not Sibanye, not AmPlats, not Northam, and not Impala. Those are our four players in the PGM sector. Today, while I was sitting up there, Sibanye's results came out, and they cut half of their Stillwater production by 200,000 ounces. So we actually were actually expecting them to do that, because Sibanye, in our mind, was playing games and effectively running out of money. In fact, in 6 months, they breached covenants. In 6 months' time, we thought they were going to the wall. So sorry for all of you who you speculate in Sabania, but it's literally dire. But we knew they had to do something now. They can't wait for the next set of results. So we anticipated them shutting something down. It looks like they've shut half of Stillwater. And they happened to shut it a day after Anglo's placed a very large portion of Amplats into the market as well. So I think yesterday was a great opportunity. So we actually took some of the placement in Amplats at 5.11, plus bought more. Did some structures as well where we actually sold puts, etc. I won't get involved in that. And we closed our shorts yesterday. So yesterday was our expecting a cut, and we've got a cut, probably not as big as required because it's still 200,000 ounces. Would have liked the whole of Stillwater to be shut. But I do think this could be an interesting entry point for Amplats, particularly because it is lower on the cost curve. It would survive the longest. And even though it's a very tough industry, I don't believe that EVs are taking over forever. We've already seen some very interesting stats put out by major accounting firms, etc., which has already said that the EV penetration is slowing, as not as growing as fast as predicted, and people are sticking a lot more to ICE vehicles because the end result is when you try to sell your EV vehicle years down the line, you're going to find out that what you've got left with is a shell that needs a new battery, and the new battery costs more than a car, so no one wants to buy it. So I think there are some big issues with EVs that are only starting to get found out now.
Us meaning internal
combustion engines. Sorry.
That's an interesting point that you've made there. Would you not feel that now that one person's blinked, others will blink as well? Or will they take your view as to say, well, there's 200,000 ounces out of the system, things are the demand supply equation is going to be more in equilibrium.
I don't think 200,000 ounces is enough yet. So I think 500,000 is probably what's required, but it's a start. I mean, the basket of PGMs, platinum group metals, that's required to go into a catalytic converter costs today one third of what it costs a few years ago. So, I mean, that basket has dropped significantly. So there, can imagine a mine selling price being down two-thirds of what they were selling, but meantime, their costs over the last few years have gone up, electricity, staff, everything. I mean, those businesses are losing an untold fortune unless they are low on the cost curve. So I think we need more cuts, but it's the first cut, and these things have fallen a lot. So I caution people not to be short at these levels when...
So the Chinese are also moving more and more towards hybrid models rather than just pure electric vehicles, which is also, I suppose, something to take account of. Bruce Dacres says, given US debt at an all-time high and their propensity to print money, are we not once again facing a financial meltdown?
I think the world's got used to this. I think debt's never coming down. So there's no way of ever repaying debt, you know, and I think... whatever trillion dollars number we're at now, I think in 10 or 15 years' time, there's going to be a new word, quadrillion or whatever the thousand trillion represents. So I think the printing never stops, which does mean that inflation probably never comes back to the lower levels that the US, you know, wanted, the below 2%, et cetera. Probably going to have to settle at a higher inflation number. But I don't think this means a massive crisis. I think it needs... like we had in 2008, it needs an event. It's not the debt that causes it. It was what they stupidly did by repackaging all these mortgages into AAA, etc., securities, and they thought they'd never default. So it needs stupid behavior. And I don't think we're at a point now where we've seen massive stupid behavior. But who knows, with the Democrats or Trump, we could have this.
And South Africa and the South African debt situation, how does that compare?
Well, on a relative basis, yes, we are higher. I think our debt to GDP number is close to 80%, if that's correct.
And it's over 70.
Over 70, yes. Yeah. Trending towards 80%. On a global scale, on a relative comparative number, it's not a big number. So it seems big to where we were in the past, but every country's much larger than it was in the past. So I think overall it's manageable.
Chris DeLange's question is, hi Si, if you're happy to disclose, what are your current short positions and why?
So I probably wouldn't disclose any South African shorts. I think because also, you know, they may be shorts just because we think they're currently overvalued relative to something. So for example, and this is not a short, had we been short Nedbank now and long Standard Bank, it doesn't necessarily mean we don't like Nedbank. It means we think there's an arbitrage of Standard Bank relative to Nedbank. So effectively, by shorting Nedbank and buying Standard Bank, we're effectively taking no market risk or no banking risk. And if the gap closes, we're still making money. So we're doing a trade without taking any banking risk. So it doesn't mean, again, that I don't like Nedbank. I just might find Standard Bank cheaper. So that trade's done for a specific reason. That's why we probably won't mention that kind of a stock as, for example, a short. Luckily today also, we don't have the Steinhoffs and African Banks and Resilience and all those companies. And to be honest, we don't see many, well, I don't see any South African listed companies that have behaved in that kind of manner of late, which is good. But we are short many South African companies because we find them overvalued or relative overvalued. What I would disclose is probably US shorts. And I mentioned one here before, which is Tesla. And it is, yes, part of the Magnificent Seven, and it's done phenomenally well over time. But when I look at the balance sheet, the income statement, the cash flow, the gross margins, the operating margins, everything is deteriorating. Even the volume growth story is gone. And the only reason they're getting any growth now is because they're now financing vehicles at 0% in a high interest rate environment. I mean, zero down and 0% for 5 years. So, and the Chinese have caught up to such an extent in technology. Those of you who maybe even looked at some of these Chinese vehicles that are in South Africa, the plug-in hybrids or the pure EVs, they are far cheaper. We don't have Teslas here, unfortunately. But Tesla is a good car, and Musk is a genius. Don't get me wrong. But the company itself, from a fundamental point of view, is dramatically overvalued. And I know someone over here will disagree with me whose wife loves the company. Listening. So, you know, and it, but it has halved. It was at $400. It's now $200 and something. So it's come down. But relative to what it's worth, it's still ridiculously overvalued, and we are short. Another short example is ARC, which is Cathie Wood. Those of you who followed her throughout her escapades into various technology companies, including Tesla, which today is still one of her biggest investments. You know, a lot of the investments she's made into companies, those companies have disintegrated. You know, they're about a dream and a prayer, and many of them don't even have the underlying technology that follows through. So I think those are the kind of things we look for. You know, businesses that are potentially highly valued where, you know, it's just they're just not showing the traction or the growth or the cash flow, and things are actually going backwards in some cases, but the valuation is still going up. I actually think in Tesla's case, I'm almost certain that it's absolutely a manipulated stock, even at its size, which is hundreds of billions of dollars. I've got my own theories on how that gets done, but there's daily call option market, and there's a huge amount of money that sits offshore, controlled by Musk, in islands with mandates that allow to trade equities anywhere, independent via trustees and structures, etc. I'm convinced. That's why I don't think, actually, I might never actually get to see the day that Tesla falls in a heap, because I don't think the price is real, which is a problem. But I tell you one thing, the company's eightfold overvalued.
We do know that Elon Musk is a entrepreneur of the extreme type, where with SpaceX, for instance, it was only, he had three failures with his rockets, and it was on the fourth one, and he'd hocked everything, was sleeping on couches, that actually did succeed. That didn't blow up. He's betting everything on Tesla, on robo-taxis. If he gets it right, as happened with SpaceX rocket number four, would that change your view?
I don't think you ever get... Well, first of all, he's not a leader in robo-taxis. I mean, if you've seen the Chinese ones, forgot the name now, of the company that does it, they're ahead. Technology-wise, in full-service driving, he's still not even a level three. He's a level two in Tesla. There are host of dozen type companies whose first service, full service driving technology ticked by government are above the technology of Tesla. So, you know, he luckily controls the rhetoric on Twitter, which is another business, plus SpaceX, plus XAR, plus all the other businesses, Neuralink that he's involved in. I'm not sure how one person can really be the CEO of five businesses. Like, to me, he almost represents kind of like what's wrong with the market at the moment. I mean, what's wrong is that fundamentals have gone. I mean, how can you have a CEO running five different businesses, you know, and being called out for 50, I won't call them lies, call them estimations that never came to fruition over the past 5 years, but yet the company still remains worth. I mean, in South Africa, that company would have been wiped out by now because the South African market is a fundamental valuation market. The US is not.
It's quite interesting you mentioned that because the only other person who took it on themselves to manage two huge businesses like that was Steve Jobs, Apple and Pixar. And it nearly, well, Next and Pixar before he went back to Apple. And that killed him in the end of the day. I guess the question has to be, if Musk dies through whatever reason, what would that do to Tesla and
One of the people in our team, I won't mention, says the only catalyst that will cause Tesla to collapse is that actual event. And I don't wish Musk any harm because he is a good man, he's a visionary, and he's done a lot of good. But yeah, I do question with the cult and the cult following, if anything will ever happen to that price.
Extraordinary. Well, I guess that's what makes markets different. It's an interesting point you make, though, about robo-taxis. I have a good friend who was very, very senior at General Motors, and I was talking to him recently. He's retired now. He was head of quality control for all of GM. And he said, I asked him about Chinese cars, and he said it's like we regard Japanese cars years ago. Jap scrap, remember? Toyotas were rubbish, and today no one would say a Toyota is rubbish. It's probably high quality. He says the Chinese cars are at that level now where the reputation hasn't caught up with the quality. And if you extrapolate that to what you're now saying about robo-taxis and the Chinese being ahead, that is a worrying factor for any Tesla bull.
Well, I think Musk knows, in fact, that robo-taxis are not his future because his most recent statement was everybody having a humanoid robot, in fact, being your, and he thinks that's where the value is going to lie in Tesla now. So, okay. And everyone told him initially it wasn't in selling cars, then he made it in FSD and robo-taxis, and now people are questioning that because other Chinese players are in that game. So now he's saying he's developing a humanoid robot, which is going to live in one of your homes and do everything for you. It's going to do your washing, your dump, you know, whatever. And the truth is, those of you who follow like Boston Robotics, a company, I mean, they are 20,000 gazillion years ahead of where Tesla are on robots. So it's very unlikely that Tesla now suddenly become the lead in humanoid robots. And he had at his last show, he put one of these robots on stage and it did a few walkarounds and, you know, it didn't look very impressive. But the cult believes. So as long as they believe, nothing will happen.
Michael Potts says, Sir, given your comments on the property sector and the growth in the informal sector, what is your view now of listed retail property funds who have properties in rural and township areas?
Great, great question. We hated property 2018, 19, 20, 21, and 22. We were short the property sector. We never stopped shorting it from the resilience, the green bays, the whatever that was listed at the time, and we continued the growth points, etc. Last year, 2023, our biggest attribution in our long only fund came from the property sector on the long side. So we foresaw in the last year and 2 years that number one, we'd reached peak interest rates. Number two, no one is going to build new offices anymore, and offices have enormous, enormous vacancy. But we are starting to get a little bit of that go back to the office. Not that I actually go back to the office that much, but a lot of people are going back to the office, and it has picked up. and retail has remained good. It's, you know, yes, we did open probably a few too many out, you know, retail malls and maybe a little bit too big in some of the outlying areas. But the sector had devalued to such an extent from the end of 2017 to, say, the beginning of 2023. I'm talking about a 70% odd devaluation in equity value over like a six-year period that has become too cheap. And the players within the industry, both rural and non-rural, had brought down valuations in their financials. The cash flows have started equaling the income statement income. The dividend yields have obviously slightly picked up because you've seen a small amount of growth from informal and formal. And you got to a state where the sector's really been too cheap. And in fact, pre-election to now, most of those stocks are up 30, 40%. I mean, Growthpoint was at 10 Rand, it's at 14. We own quite a bit of it. We own a lot of like Fairvest, where we probably own more than 10% of the company. We own huge amounts of Vukile. I think we're about to put out an announcement that we've gone over a certain level maybe. So we like the sector. And rates haven't started being cut yet. And many of the players have pretty high LTVs, loan to value. So the gearing is quite high. So when you get rates coming down, it's got an added effect to earnings. And I think that's going to be good. So, yeah, we like the property sector.
Pete spoke about Lollapalooza South African stocks. Would you agree with that? And if so, or if not, are there any Lollapaloozas in your world?
You know, I think we're a little bit different to Pitt. I mean, I think because our AUM is quite a bit bigger, so we have got a few of those very small cap opportunities, and we do like a few of them. And I wouldn't want to mention them by name, but I mean, you could go out and find them. There are some stocks trading at 5 and 6 multiples and 6 or 7% dividend yields. And we have been buying a few of them. And we've even got some that we think, you know, could return to glory. I mean, I'll give you one example. We have a very small stake in Famous Brands. Famous Brands was a darling of the market, you know, a decade ago. The share price today is 1/3 of what it was maybe 10 years ago. The earnings aren't growing at the rate that it should be. I mean, fast food is a big growth area. I mean, we've seen food delivery being a big growth area, and they've got all these brands that benefit. So if there were to be a few small fixes in that business, for example, you know, us and a couple of other asset managers have bought small stakes in it and trying to create a little bit of change. I think if you can create that change, those kind of businesses can be growth businesses again.
There's some wonderful brands in there. You know a lot about retail at 361. Evan Walker still works for you.
Correct.
Yeah, one of the best retail analysts. Pick and Pay. We had Sean here in March. I thought he was quite impressive, but the feedback we're getting in the marketplace is not good. He's not getting to turn it around. Are you reading something different?
Yeah, funny. When he was here last time, we had dinner with him that night, and it's the first time I've had dinner with him. So I got to know him from then. I think it's a tough one. If you ask me, Pick and Pay, the brand and the actual grocery store, in my mind, it's never going to catch up. It's finished. But the listed company is a different animal because it owns Boxer. And many of you here probably don't know Boxer or shop at Boxer, but Boxer's actually growing faster than ShopRite. And Boxer's a phenomenal business, and they're going to list Boxer and sell a percentage of their Boxer to raise capital to keep funding the holes that are at Pick and Pay in the grocery business. So I don't think the grocery business can ever return to what it was before. And in fact, in most upmarket malls today, tenants are sometimes refusing to pay rent if it's a Pick and Pay, not a Checkers or a Woolworths. They don't want Pick and Pays in their, you know, in their shopping centers. So I think it's going to be very difficult for Pick and Pay to make a comeback as a brand, you know. And the amount of money that ShopRite is spending per year in capex and revitalizing their Checkers and their ShopRite stores is about equal to 50% of the entire market cap of Pick and Pay. So Pick and Pay has got no chance. But its chance for the share price recovery is Boxer, and Pick and Pay Clothing is also not a bad business. So I'm not convinced the share price is a short. I think, in fact, with the Boxer. Boxer could be more valuable in the entire market cap. And I think it might be listed at a time where we got South Africa doing quite well. So I think Boxer has got potential, and therefore Pick and Pay share price has got potential. But that's different to the brand itself.
Is that Boxer? Is that Pat Goss's old business?
That's, yeah, he was in, he would think so. Good job.
Yeah. But Mickey Goss usually comes to these conferences. He's, his brother was one of the better businessmen in South Africa, one of the founders of FirstRand, but he never worked there.
Yeah.
And he kept his shares. Very clever. Final question, Adam Kethro. Do you like Anglo American?
We actually currently buy Anglo American, so I shouldn't really tell you that. We bought some this morning. We bought some yesterday. We haven't liked commodities for some time in South Africa because of the slowdown in China. I mean, the housing market in China has imploded. And I think unless China is building and adding infrastructure, commodity companies generally don't do that well. Having said that, we think the Chinese slowdown is starting to hit somewhere near rock bottom. We saw some more stimulus from the Chinese government this morning, further cut in rates. And I think we're nearing the bottom there. And Anglo's is in play. So Anglo's, as you know, BHP made an offer, never actually happened. They now have got to sit out a period of time. But Anglo's knows that it's in play, and that's why yesterday even they sold some of their Amplats in the market, which I mentioned we took. So I think on a breakup value and the fact that it has very valuable copper assets in it, and copper is the way to go. This whole world's going to build many more data centers and AI centers and EV charging stations, etc. The one component you need for all of this is copper. And the world does not have enough copper. And I think looking forward 5 or 10 years, copper price is going to go up substantially, and that's going to become our new great commodity to be invested in. And Anglo's has got a lot of it. So I like Anglo's, but, you know, just going slowly. It's going to take time.
More than Anglo Platinum?
I think Anglo Platinum, I'm concerned about the longevity of platinum group metals. So I like Anglo Platinum now because of its extreme valuation of close to 500 Rand. I wouldn't believe in it, you know, forever because it's actually in platinum group metals, which I'm not sure what they're, you know, if everyone lands up in 15 years time driving EVs and your battery allows you to drive 5,000 kilometers on one charge, you know, no one's going to buy an ICE vehicle, you know. So I think that it's a difficult one. But it's just cheap now. I think Anglo's copper asset is more exciting than the platinum group metals longer term.
Thank you for your clarity of thought, as always, sir. Thanks, Si Jacobs.